1933, Jury declares war. The English edition of Mein Kampf was still in the process of printing and publication when Jury declared war on the National Socialist regime, and started an intensive blockade against Germany. The International Jewish Boycott Conference was assembled in Holland in the summer of 1933 under the presidency of Mr. Samuel Untermeyer of the USA, who was elected president of the World Jewish Economic Federation formed to combat the opposition to Jews in Germany. On his return to the USA, Mr. Untermeyer gave an address over station WABC, the text of which, as printed in the New York Times of August 7, 1933, I have before me. Mr. Untermeyer referred in the opening phrases to the holy war and the cause of humanity in which we are embarked, and proceeded to develop the subject at great length, describing the Jews as the aristocrats of the world. Each of you, Jew and Gentile alike, who has not already enlisted in this sacred war should do so now and here. Those Jews who did not join in, he denounced, declaring, they are traitors to their race. In January 1934, Mr. Jabotinsky, founder of Revisionist Zionism, wrote in At Jarech, the fight against Germany has been carried out for months by every Jewish community, conference, trade organization, by every Jew in the world. We shall let loose a spiritual and a material war of the whole world against Germany. This is perhaps the most confident assertion extant on the Jewish claim, set out in the Protocols of Zion, that they can bring about war. Protocol number 7 states, we must be in a position to respond to every act of opposition by a state by war with its neighbor. If these should venture to stand collectively, by universal war, like the never-ending war on terror today, it should be remembered here that a copy of these protocols was filed in the British Museum in 1906. By 1938, the Jewish war was in full swing, and already through their influence or pressure many Gentile persons and groups were being drawn into the vortex. Various members of the British Socialist Party were openly advocating joining in this Cold War, and a vigorous and uncompromising clique was growing in all parties under the leadership of Messrs. Churchill, Amory, Duff, Cooper and others. Hitler will have no war, but he will be forced to it, not this year, but later on, screamed the Jew Emil Ludwig in the June copy of Les Annales 1934. On June 3, 1938, matters were carried a long step further by an article in the American Hebrew, the weekly organ of American Jewry. This article, which opened by showing that Hitler never deviated from his Mein Kampf doctrine, went on to threaten the direst retaliation. It has become patent that a combination of Britain, France and Russia will sooner or later bar the triumphant march of Hitler either by accident or design. A Jew has come to a position of foremost importance in each of these nations. In the hands of non-Aryans lies the fate and the very lives of millions. In France the Jew of prominence is Leon Blum. Leon Blum may yet be the Moses who will lead. Maxim Litvinov, Soviet super salesman, is the Jew who sits at the right hand of Stalin, the little tin soldier of communism. The English Jew of prominence is Leslie Horby Lisha, Tommy Atkins' new boss. Later in this article we read, so it may come to pass that these three sons of Israel will form a combine that will send the frenzied Nazi dictator to hell. And when the smoke of battle clears, and the man who played the swastika Christus is lowered into a hole in the ground, as the trio of non-Aryans intone a ramified requiem, a medley of the Marseillaise, God Save the King, and the Internation Ale, blending with a proud and aggressive rendering of Eli Eli. 2 points in the above extract are worthy of special note. Firstly, it is taken for granted that these three Jews will not for one moment think or act as anything but Jews, and can be relied upon to guide their Gentile dupes to ruin in a plainly Jewish war. Secondly, should be noted the contemptuous reference to the swastika Christus, which Jury looks forward to burying, and which reveals by its classification the Jewish hatred of Christianity. Meantime, Jewish pressure was exerted to the utmost to incite clashes between Sudeten, Czechs, Poles and Germans. By September of 1938, matters had reached a desperate pass. Mr. Chamberlain himself flew out to Munich and achieved a historic settlement with Hitler. It seemed as though the warmongers had been frustrated, and Europe saved. Rarely had such scenes and evidences of spontaneous delight and thankfulness been evoked as were witnessed throughout Britain and Europe at that triumph. Those who knew the power of the enemy, however, knew that Mr. Chamberlain's work was certain to be swiftly sabotaged. I remember remarking, on the very evening of his return from Munich, that within a week every newspaper in this country and the warmongers in Parliament would be attacking Mr. Chamberlain for having secured peace, regardless of the fact that in so doing they were contemptuously flouting the real wishes of the people. This remark was only too true, as events proved. Nowhere was the Jewish fury so obvious, of course, as in Moscow. I have before me a leaflet of my own designing put out in October 1938. It runs, "Are you aware that Mr. Chamberlain was burnt in effigy in Moscow as soon as it was known that he had secured peace, showing very clearly who wanted war, and who are still ceaselessly working to stir up strife all the world over?" See Appendix 4. The attempt to provoke war over Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia having failed, there remained only the detonator in the Polish corridor, that monstrosity born of the unholy Versailles Conference, and denounced by honest men from Marshal Foch and Arthur Henderson. From that time onwards, one feature about the Versailles Conference has been kept secret by those who possess the power to keep things from the public or to proclaim things from the housetops. It is this: all important decisions were taken by the Big Four, Britain, France, Italy and the USA, represented respectively by Mr. Lloyd George, M. Klemenkawa, Baron Sonnino and President Wilson. So much is known. What is not known is that the secretary of Mr. Lloyd George was the Jew Sassoon, of M. Klemenkawa the Jew Mandel Rothschild, now known as Mandel. Baron Sonnino was himself half a Jew, and President Wilson had the Jew Brandeis. The interpreter was another Jew named Mantu, and the military advisor yet another Jew called Kish. It is known that Mr. Lloyd George and others were hazy about geography. Their Jewish secretaries, however, were on the contrary very much on the spot on such matters. These Jews met at 6 p.m. in the evenings, and mapped out the decisions for the following day's conference of the Big Four. The results were disastrous from the point of view of all decent people, who hoped for an honorable treaty, with terms which, though they might be stringent, would at least be just and thereby secure lasting peace. Foch himself loudly denounced the treaty, declaring that it contained the certain makings of another war and deprecating in particular the provision relating to Danzig and the corridor. Arthur Henderson and many public men joined in the denunciation, but all to no avail. From the point of view of men planning another war, however, nothing could have been better than this treaty. All sorts of glaring injustices were ingrained in its text. In addition to the corridor, and the position at Danzig, a bastard state was brought into being, in which Germans, Slovaks, etc., together forming a majority of the country, were put under the tyrannical control of the Czech minority, an element which had thrown in its lot with the Bolshevik Jews and fought against the Allies in 1918. The design of this state was such geographically that it was styled, and correctly styled, a dagger pointed at the heart of Germany. It received the outlandish name of Czechoslovakia. The whole of the industrial life from the huge Skoda arsenal downwards was controlled by Jewish banking interests, while we have it on the evidence of Lord Winterton that practically all the land was mortgaged to the Jews. Hansard, October 1936. Under this messianic domination were enslaved huge sections of populations, belonging to other nations, henceforward condemned to be held down by force until some country should grow strong enough to champion them. This eventuality was, in my opinion, visualized and actually fostered as we know by the huge loans to Germany from international banking interests. Let it not be forgotten that while Jewish bankers were pouring money into Germany, which was rebuilding the Wehrmacht on a bigger scale than ever, A colossal campaign for peace and disarmament was launched in this country. This not only succeeded in substantially disarming us, but in creating an atmosphere in which Mr. Baldwin had to admit that he dared not go to the country asking for more armaments, vital though he knew our needs in sea, air and land forces to be. All prior, of course, to the rise of Hitler. To anyone who made a study of the personalities and powers behind this so-called peace propaganda, as I did, there can be no doubt as to whence the real drive and finance emanated. To anyone appreciating the attitude of the press at that time, and realizing that had this disarmament propaganda been distasteful to those who influence our publicity services, there would have blared forth a torrent of invective against our peace balloters, there is additional proof that this campaign had the support of international Jewry, as had the rearmament of Germany. But why? The simple will ask. The answer is fairly simple, if once the purpose behind the Jewish plan is understood. Out of the last war we brought the Soviet states of Russia. Out of the next war we will bring the Soviet states of Europe. Had been the pronouncement at a world meeting of communist parties about 1932. To make the next war possible, therefore, the seesaw must be balanced again. German strength built up, and British strength whittled down. Then the Europeans can fight each other to the death of one and complete exhaustion of the other. A dramatic surprise is in store for both sides. Neither is to be the real winner. The real winner is quite a different army. This army is the one that will receive the real attention. For 25 years it will be built up under conditions of the greatest secrecy. Its leaders will not show their strength until the conflict is well underway. Not until a critical moment in the war will the European armies be permitted to guess at the existence of the huge factories beyond the Urals, or of the colossal proportions of the heavily mechanized hordes which will then commence to roll westwards over Europe under the red flag of Marxism. In March 1939, a British guarantee to Poland was given by Mr. Chamberlain on the strength of a false report to the effect that a 48-hour ultimatum had been delivered by Germany to the Poles. This report subsequently turned out to be quite untrue. The guarantee had been given, however, and the decision of peace or war was now no longer in British hands. Jewry had the ball at its feet. Can we doubt but that Poland was encouraged to ignore the German note of March which set forth eminently reasonable suggestions for a peaceful solution of the problem of the corridor? Month after month no reply was vouchsafed by Poland to the German note. Meanwhile, insult and outrage occurred with suspicious frequency all along the German frontier, similar to the technique to which the Jews later introduced the British in Palestine. Day after day the British public was deluged with war propaganda and misrepresentation of the situation. Finally, their minds were closed against any further regard to the demands of justice or reason by a new slogan, "You cannot trust Hitler's word." With this lie the British public was finally stampeded into throwing all reason and judgment to the winds and accepting at their face value the war propaganda in the press. This slogan was founded upon a misrepresentation of Hitler's assurance given on more than one occasion after a push such as that into Sudetenland, that he intended to make no further demands. The misrepresentation lay in the fact that the press steadily obscured a major fact, that the demands to which Hitler referred were all along fivefold in character, and covered those five areas taken from Germany by a dictated peace in which the population was overwhelmingly German, i.e. Sudetenland, part of Czechoslovakia, parts of Poland, the corridor in Danzig. As German troops occupied each successive section, it is, I believe, accurate to say that Hitler declared that he had no additional demands to make. But here it must be clearly stated in the interests of justice that he never said that this entailed reducing the demands which he had originally very clearly delineated, and repeated on many occasions, namely, the five areas in question. The British public was deluded by its press into supposing that when Hitler said he had no further demands, that there had never been any statement of his full demands, some of which were still unfulfilled. They were led to believe that Hitler either never had any other demands, or that he had abandoned the rest as soon as he had obtained some of them. When, therefore, the next installment was added, the press built on this misunderstanding the fallacy that Hitler's word could not be trusted. Honest dealing needs no such trickery and deception. Such methods are only necessary to bolster up bad or unjust causes. Fortunately, we have the calm and dispassionate judgment in this matter by no less a person than the late Lord Lothian, recently British ambassador to the USA. In his last speech at Chatham House on this subject, he remarked, "If the principle of self-determination had been applied in Germany's favor, as it was applied against her, it would have meant the return of Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia, parts of Poland, the Polish corridor, and Danzig to the Reich. Here is a very different presentment of the case to the one which was foisted upon the British public in 1939, and it is the true one. Small wonder that these facts had to be withheld from the ordinary citizen. Had the British public realized the truth, that each of these demands of Hitler's rested on a foundation of reasonable fairness, the people of this island would have ruled out any question of war. And it was war, not truth or justice, upon which international Jewry was resolved."